There's a culture war going on in this country. We can no longer remain silent on the issues that affect us all. Decisions we make now will determine our future. But how do we engage with the culture in a way that honors Jesus? How do we rise above the noise to know what is right and what is true? It's time to bring God back into the conversation. It's time to reconnect. Here's Carmen.
Welcome, friends. I'm Carmen LaBurge, and this is The Reconnect, where we're putting God in His place, back where He belongs, in the middle of every conversation. We do that by entering into the conversations of the day as the ambassadors of Jesus Christ, seeking to bring the mind of Christ to bear on the matters of the day. And in order to do that, we need to cultivate the mind of Christ. We need to actually know what the gospel is, and that also means we need to be able to ferret out when false gospels are being presented to us or among us. And so we're going to talk about that here in this half hour of the show. I would invite you to connect with us online. The website is reconnectwithcarmen.com. We've got a survey up there right now for our listeners. We'd love if you would go and participate in that so we can know how we are serving you and how we can better serve you through the show. So up first is the inauguration of the new president. This is not going to surprise anybody that this is what we're talking about, because we like to talk about what everybody's talking about. And this is it right now. So tomorrow we will all experience the inauguration of the 45th president of the United States. And it's going to happen at noon Eastern time. And Donald J. Trump is going to place his hand on the Lincoln Bible, we understand, in addition to a Bible that his mother gave him when he was in Sunday school. Mike Pence will be sworn in as the vice president. He's going to use the Reagan family Bible, and it's going to be opened to a particular verse that he has chosen. And then Clarence Thomas, Supreme Court Justice, is going to actually do the swearing in of the president and the vice president. And there will be prayers offered, and that's what we're going to talk about right now, the offering of those prayers, who's going to be participating in that, why we should care. And to help us talk about the public theology of one of the individuals that is going to be offering prayers tomorrow is Colson Center's Breakpoint host, John Stonestreet. John's been on our program before, so John, welcome back.
Thank you so much. Great to be on with you again.
All right, so tell us who Paula White is. Who is she? Why do we need to know who she is?
Well, you know, Paula White was someone who's has a ministry in Florida. She's the pastor of a church down there, and she's a televangelist. You sometimes would see her on networks like TBN and other places. But the context of this is even a little bit larger than who she particularly is. You know, several years ago, Senator Grassley led an investigation of several television evangelists because of the lavishness of their lifestyle and just, you know, and so on. Now, I am one that would not want at all to give Congress power to determine what is good theology and what is not good theology, or what is good ecclesiastical practice and what is not. I mean, they have no business in that. But it was the really the lifestyle and so on of this particular group of individuals, folks like Benny Hinn. I mean, some of the more familiar names of what's typically known as the prosperity gospel that created this. I mean, just basically checking for abuse and so on. That's kind of the context of this, was that investigation. Now, the other context of this, I think, is important to mention, is that during this whole campaign, and I don't begrudge President-elect Trump from inviting whoever he wants to pray at his inauguration. That's his prerogative, and that's something that he can do. And he's certainly, dancing with the ones that brought him, I guess you could say, because Paula White played a significant role in bringing a segment of the population, behind Mr. Trump, particularly in Florida. And so, you know, I think that's at least part of what's going on here. But what's happened is we have a press and a media that really doesn't have the ability, that they don't have the knowledge to really distinguish between different expressions of Christianity, between those that are kind of in the center of orthodoxy and those that aren't. I mean, we keep hearing that number of 81% of evangelicals that voted, for Trump, and that's kind of lumping everyone who would call themselves that together. And so what Christians have to do these days is kind of bring clarity. I mean, the topic of the prosperity gospel is now front and center. It's a movement that's front and center, not only because of the popularity on media, but now because of this national political attention of individuals that fall into that movement. And I think it's up to every Christian to be able to say the difference between, no, wait, this is what the gospel is about, and this is what the prosperity gospel individuals teach and preach. And I think the prosperity gospel, by the way, is more than just even the financial prosperity that is promised and promoted by some of the more extreme examples of this. And that's something else that's worth talking about, is how the prosperity gospel and that mentality of what God exists to do and what he exists for, how that has crept even into mainstream evangelicalism.
So I think that you have lifted up some terms that there might be some people listening who now their interest is piqued and they're thinking to themselves, okay, he used the term evangelical. I think I know what that is, but now maybe I'm not so sure. And he used the term prosperity gospel, and he distinguished that from the gospel of Jesus Christ. So if you would, don't try to define evangelical, because I think we've worn ourselves out, at least for the time being, in trying to do that. But let's do define for the listeners what the prosperity gospel is from your viewpoint.
Yeah, well, I mean, look, the prosperity gospel is simply this. It's basically treating God like a genie, like a source of positive resources whose purpose is to bless us according to not his will, but according to our will. And some of the more extreme forms of this would teach that God actually wants you to be rich. And if you're not rich, if you're not prospering or wealthy, if you're not succeeding, then you're not exhibiting enough faith, or you're not in line, you're not claiming it enough, or, you know, things like that. I think some of the church fathers would scratch their head at the sort of life that their faith led them into, and, you know, in terms of that sort of teaching, you know, that following Christ doesn't guarantee success. It certainly doesn't guarantee material wealth. But this mentality that God is kind of a divine genie, this is not just kind of reserved for some of the more extreme examples that we might see on TBN or other places. I mean, you know, there's a mentality oftentimes, you know, I've worked for years dealing with teenagers, and, you know, well-meaning parents and youth pastors will say things to students like, well, if you just stay a virgin until you're married and you are pure, then God will bring you your prince charming or princess charming, and you'll have a great married life. It's that same sort of mentality that if you play by the rules and you have enough faith, then God will bless you with exactly what you want. And then that's just, you know, that's just not true. There's also not only the financial prosperity, but just meaning and purpose, the idea of your best life now. Joel Osteen often doesn't promise things like financial prosperity, but it's this idea that if, you know, God wants you to succeed and he wants you to go, advance in your career, and he wants to give you all these things. You know, it's interesting that we're having this conversation, by the way, Carmen, at the same time that, you know, Martin Scorsese's film of the Japanese novelist Endo's book, Silence, is out. I mean, here you have people following Christ who are led directly into persecution. We know that that's actually been the norm across Christian history. We know that our brothers and sisters in other parts of the world right now are facing incredible persecution. We know the Open Doors report has said that 2016 was the worst year on record for Christian persecution, which is closely followed by 2015, which is followed by 2014. I mean, we're in a time where the majority of Christians around the globe, around the planet, are following the Lord, following Jesus, and it's not leading them to prosperity. And the reason is God never promised that. He never did. And that's the distinction. The real gospel, of course, is the gospel that, you know, our problem isn't that we lack resources or that we lack wealth. Our problem is that we lack righteousness, that we're actually wicked and sinful. We don't need to be made better. We need to be made new. We don't need to be, improved upon. We don't need to be advanced in our career. We actually need to be forgiven from God's wrath. And that's really what Christ came to do, is take on that penalty for our sin. And that's the core of the gospel, and that the world is his, not ours. The world is not ours to seize. It's not our, oyster to get our own pearl out of. No. The world belongs to God, and the earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof. And we're supposed to care for it as his world, and our sin, has separated us from God, and he came to rescue us. I mean, that's a very different message than the idea that somehow the gospel is about us kind of achieving our best right now.
Absolutely. Friends, we're talking to John Stone Street. You know him as the host of Breakpoint, and you can listen to that message every day at breakpoint.org. You can follow John on Twitter at JB, as in boy, Stone Street. John, well, first of all, I want to highlight for our listeners, he just alluded to the Open Doors USA report, and you all will remember that we just talked to Kristen Wright yesterday about the Open Doors 50 countries that we're focusing on this year in terms of our persecuted brothers and sisters around the world. And we were reminded, John, that the church itself is persecuted. And we who live in this particular context sort of lose sight oftentimes of what the reality is for most Christians around the globe, because our perspective is what it is here in the United States. And so thank you for lifting that up and reminding us of that. If I can, let me change gears here for just a moment, because I think it's notable that Trump has selected people to pray tomorrow who he understands, who he perceives to be evangelical. And he perceives, I think, all three of the people who he's invited to pray, Franklin Graham and Timothy Dolan and Paula White. I think he perceives all of them to be evangelical. One of the things they certainly all advocate and hold is a pro-life position. And so I do think that as we survey what's happening in the Trump administration, as it emerges before us, that all three of these individuals are pro-life. And in the week when this Women's March on Washington is going to exclude women who are not pro-abortion, and then next week when there will be the March for Life and Kellyanne Conway and another female advisor to the president is going to actually address the March for Life, which is unprecedented. That has never happened, that a ranking member of the administration would be actually speaking live to the March for Life. And so I think there's something going on. There's something stirring. I'm not exactly willing to point to what it is, but there does seem to be a trend, a cultural trend that's worth noting in the right direction, as abortion rates are certainly lower than they were immediately after Roe v. Wade. So does it feel to you like at least on that one issue, there is some positive evidence of a cultural trend toward life?
Oh, listen, yeah, and I wouldn't even just say that issue. I think there are others as well. And I want to be clear. I'm not begrudging Mr. Trump for choosing Paula White or whatever. It makes perfect sense. I just think it's an opportunity for Christians to make that clarification. And I think Christian churches and pastors need to make that clarification and not fall into the temptation of doing a prosperity-minded gospel, you know, even if they're not talking about money, but they're talking about emotional health and well-being or whatever. I mean,
Absolutely. It's just, we
just need to make that distinction. On the life issue, it's funny. I was just, yeah, I mean, I think it's so fascinating. I was just speaking with someone today, going back over some headlines from 2016 about how the pro-life movement was over, specifically because of the Supreme Court decision that overturned the Texas law and rolled back some of the state-level legislation that we had seen passed over the last, or really since 2010. And I think, you know, at that point there was an expectation that there was going to be a different president in the White House, one that really was, you know, running on the most pro-abortion platform in history. I mean, not even close. I mean, I think Hillary Clinton, by the way, would have won if she hadn't gone as extreme as she had outside of the mainstream with her pro-abortion views. And yet here we are just a few, you know, months later, and we have sitting politicians, including Speaker Ryan, you know, talking publicly about defunding Planned Parenthood. I mean, you know, this is how quickly a couple months, you know, can change things. I mean, just a few months ago, the pro-life movement's over. Now we're actually talking about the thing that up until this year has been politically untouchable, which is Roe v. Wade, at least on a federal level. I mean, you know, nothing federal has happened on Roe v. Wade. Everything that's happened has been on state. Now we're having these federal conversations and the examples that you gave. This is remarkable. And here's what happened. In 2016, the pro-abortion forces put their money in politics. They put their money in judicial decisions. They put their money in that bank. For 30 years, pro-lifers have put their resources and their time and their effort not only in personal causes, helping individuals who are in crisis pregnancies, but also in cultural realities, using technology to leverage the pro-life message, and of course, you know, caring for the broken in crisis pregnancies and so on is also cultural work. And that's what we know, right? This is what we have talked about at the Colson Center for a long time, because our founder, Chuck Colson, talked about it first. that politics is most often downstream from culture. And we have a cultural tide, a cultural shift that's happening. Look, Carmen, if we weren't so addicted as a nation to the sexual revolution, and we weren't so addicted to relativism, abortion would be long gone. The only thing, the only thing that is holding abortion, you know, in place in our culture is that our larger addictions to the sexual revolution and our larger addiction to relativism, what's true for me is not true for you. And so those are two other areas of culture that we need to address as pro-lifers in order to see the long-term change. But clearly the pendulum is shifting. Clearly those who just a few months ago were saying, we have won, are now worried that they're going to lose funding. The panic in Planned Parenthood's end-of-year email and fundraising letters, the panic in Cecile Richards' voice has been stark and somewhat, if I may be honest, at least a little bit enjoyable to watch.
Hey, friends, he said it, not me. He is John Stone Street from Breakpoint. We so appreciate our partnership and ministry with you. We're very excited that you are going to be speaking next week at the Evangelicals for Life event. Folks, we've been talking about this, but you can actually watch the live stream at evangelicals.life. You can catch John on Breakpoint, breakpoint.org. You can follow him on Twitter at JB Stone Street. And I'm pretty sure your most recent book is called Renewing All Things. Is that correct?
It's close. It's called Restoring All Things. But I have something
Restoring
else,
All Things.
Carmen, since we're talking about the pro-life issue, my friend Scott Klusendorf and I have produced now for the second year a 21-day prayer guide for life. And it walks people who are committed to pray. While we're marching on Washington at the March for Life and while we're talking about Sanctity of Life Sunday, we want to see hundreds of thousands of Christians mobilized as families, as individuals and small groups to pray that God ends this scourge. And so what the guide does, it will walk you through praying for all the different victims of abortion, certainly the unborn, but also vulnerable mothers and fathers and confused grandmothers and everybody else that have been victimized by this great evil. But then also it will train you how to have pro-life conversations. And that's been the success of the pro-life ministry. It's been deprofessionalized, and it's on the ground in every community in America. And that's the strength of it. And so folks can get that as a free download on our website. It's also an app. If you have a smartphone, you can go to the iPhone store or the App Store and just type in the 21 Days of Prayer for Life, and you can download it. It's completely free, and we'd love for everybody to use it.
21 Days of Prayer for Life. And we will post to it as well. Thank you so much, and thanks for making time for us today.
Hey, you bet. Thanks so much. God bless you.
Thanks a lot. You too. All right, friends. So it's the 21 Days of Prayer for Life. It is an app you can get on your phone. It is a resource you can download. We will be sure that we link to it and push it out via my Twitter feed as well, which is at Carmen LaBurge. If you don't already follow me on Twitter, that's what you should do, because that is the way that I push out all of the information that people drop on us in the middle of a show. So let me remind you again that Evangelicals for Life is the event that's taking place the end of next week, immediately prior to, actually it's kind of surrounding, the March for Life, which also takes place at the end of next week. So just want to be highlighting those things. We'll be praying for folks who are participating in that, even as right now we have our eye on things happening in Washington, D.C. related to the election. So I want to shift gears here for a few minutes before we go to the break and talk with you about this rising tide of influence that evangelicals are having in the Trump administration. And so if you are a person who has felt like Christians have been maybe somewhat sidelined in the conversations at the highest levels of governance over some period of time, let's just say the last 8 years, then this is a message that you're going to be excited to hear. And I don't know. I mean, I have to take the word of those who are participating in the process directly. But let me tell you what those who are involved in the Trump transition team are saying about their own experience. And these are folks who have had experience dating back to the Reagan administration. And so folks who have been engaged in not only evangelical Christianity, but who have been engaged in the political world for now, you know, the lifetime of many people, but some, you know, some more than 20 years anyway, sort of 35, 36. Again, my math is so bad. That back to 81. Okay, so in the Reagan administration, we had a sense that there were a number of folks who were Christians who were actively engaged in the administration. The same was true under the Bush in the Bush years. There have been other times then when that has been less true. And so as Donald Trump put together his transition team, and the transition team is highly influential in then helping to fill the more than 4,000 positions that constitute the government that is drawn together under a new administration. And so I'm holding in my hand an article by the Baptist News Global, which is entitled Richard Land Says Evangelicals Are Getting Unprecedented Input into Trump White House. You will recognize Richard Land's name as the former Southern Baptist Convention official who is on President-elect Donald Trump's Evangelical Advisory Board. Now, the advisory board, everybody has an advisory board. In fact, they have lots of them. You know, lots of people are on advisory boards, and sometimes their advice is never sought. And sometimes their advice is sought, but not in a meaningful way. And what Richard Land is testifying to here is that he has been solicited personally multiple times for his input on particular nominees on to make personal recommendations or to supplement resume material for individuals. And he said, you know, previous administrations might listen to input from evangelical leaders, but that the Trump transition team is actively seeking their advice in ways that he's never seen before. So here's a quote. He says, some of my conservative friends and I have actually been pinching ourselves. Are we hallucinating or is this actually happening? I know a good number of people on the transition team, and I can tell you right now, about half of them think I'm liberal. That's, he's quipping there. He says, I mean, these are very conservative people. He goes on to say later in the article, this administration is going to have more conservative Christians, Catholic and evangelical, than in any administration I have been associated with or had contact with, and I have been doing this since Reagan. So, where there is an opportunity to influence, there is an opportunity to do great good, and there is an opportunity to do great harm. And so I think that you and I need to soberly be praying for those who are going to find themselves in positions of extraordinary influence in the culture. And we need to recognize that as this administration comes together, it's not just the president and the vice president and the cabinet. It is literally thousands of other people, and they inhabit offices that influence literally every part of our lives. And so I recognize that there is a desire among some to actually scale back the scope and size of the federal government and its influence and certainly its control in our everyday lives. We would like to have more freedom than we have and fewer regulations. But I would also say that in an era where Christians are being given the opportunity and therefore the responsibility of significant leadership in the federal government, we should take very great care with the opportunities that are given. And so this is the time to study up. This is the time to listen up. This is the time to pray up. These are the days in which we absolutely should not be lording it over anyone that, quote unquote, we perceive ourselves as having won, but that really there is a servant leadership attitude adopted by every Christian. Every Christian who finds themselves in a position of influence of any kind, from the local level to the highest levels of governance, we must remember that we are servant leaders. No matter what position that we're in, we're serving Christ and we're serving other people. And in serving other people, we're serving Christ. Okay, that is when we talk about being people who seek for life here to reflect kingdom realities. That's what we're talking about. When we say we want the things of the earth to be like the kingdom, that we want to advance the kingdom, that's what we're talking about. We're not talking about trying to make America a theocracy or make America a Christian nation in the same way that Israel is a Jewish nation, or frankly, many other countries are Muslim nations. That's not what we're talking about. What we're talking about is the opportunity to serve in the manner of Christ in the kingdoms of this world. All right, friends, hey, we got to go to a break. When we come back, we're going to still be talking inauguration, Obama's last press conference. Don't go away. This is The Reconnect. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm Carmen LeBurge. This is The Reconnect, where we're putting God in his place, back where he belongs, right in the middle of every conversation. So I would invite you to connect with us online. Our website is reconnectwithcarmen.com. We absolutely value your feedback, and we'd love to hear from you. And we have a survey posted there for you. I'd love for you to go to reconnectwithcarmen.com, click on the survey, let us know how you're listening. Some of you listen during, live WTLN, WAVA. We love that. We want to know that. Some of you listen via streaming, and we want to know, sort of how often you're doing that. And some of you listen via podcast. I would love to know those things, and I would love to know, we're not going to ask you who you are, but I would love to know how we're helping you. And I would also love to know, what are the kinds of conversations that you need help with? What are the conversations that are taking place that you're sitting there wondering to yourself, I wish I could ask Carmen how to get God into this conversation, because this is a bit of a porcupine. Okay, I got a whole segment on porcupines, but nobody's asked for it. So, that's a prickly mess that I'm not dealing with until somebody requests a show on porcupines. So there you go. That's a teaser for you. Okay, so President Obama speaking of a porcupine. That's not even fair to say. Okay, he had his final press conference yesterday afternoon. He talked through a number of things. One thing that he said, in case you were concerned, in case you have been worried and wondering, the outgoing president has declared, we are going to be okay. We're going to be okay.
I could not be prouder of the transformation that's taken place in our society just in the last decade. I've said before, I think we made some useful contributions to it, but the primary heroes in this stage of our growth as a democracy and a society are all the individual activists and sons and daughters and couples who courageously said, this is who I am and I'm proud of it. And that opened people's minds and opened their hearts. And eventually, laws caught up. I don't think it is something that will be reversible, because American society has changed. The attitudes of young people in particular have changed.
All right, friends, so that particular clip is not the, hey, we're going to be okay clip, which obviously you already discerned. So here is what President Obama is addressing in this particular part of his press conference yesterday. He is answering a question from a Washington Blade reporter, and the Washington Blade is an LGBT newspaper. And just to let you know, if you were to listen to the full audio of the press conference, you're going to say to yourself, well, that's not quite the clip I heard on Carmen's show. Well, that's because we edited out a long section in the middle where he kind of wanders around a little bit, which if you listen to the president very often, you know he has a tendency to do. So he's kind of hard to clip quote. And so I'm just letting you know right now, we edited out some of the answer for the sake of time. But here is basically why I'm lifting this up. President Obama absolutely sees the advancement of LGBT rights as a major contribution of his 8 years as president of the United States. And he doesn't expressly credit himself or his administration with that having happened. He's basically saying that over the past decade, he is celebrating what he views as that wonderful advancement in our culture. And he gives credit where he then thinks credit is due, which are to people who he calls heroes. And I will just tell you that as a community organizer, he's reading from the playbook, by the way, because that's what you do as a community organizer. You give all the credit to the people on the ground who are living the story that you want to have become the narrative of the culture. So that's what he's doing. He's pointing back at the people whose stories were elevated in no small measure by his administration, but whose stories were elevated in such a way that those stories became the narrative of our culture. And that has resulted in a very significant level of acceptance of gay marriage in America today. And so why am I bringing this up? Well, Pew Research did a survey just last week about the perceptions that people have in terms of who is going to gain influence and who is going to lose influence in the culture in view of the change of administrations. So as Obama leaves office, by this time tomorrow, he will be done. And as Trump comes into office, by this time tomorrow, he will be the president of the United States. Who's going to lose influence and who's going to gain influence? So if you go to the Pew Research Center website, you can find this. The article says public sees wealthy people, corporations gaining influence in Trump era. There's lots of other ways they could have titled this article, by the way. It could be people see whites and men and conservative Christians gaining influence in the Trump era. It could have been they see the military and business gaining influence in the Trump era. There were a number of ways that they could have gone in terms of highlighting this. They could have also highlighted this from a negative viewpoint. They could have said, they could have led with, gays and lesbians are going to lose influence in a Trump administration versus the influence that they have experienced in the Obama years. And so when President Obama says, I don't think that this is going to change, I believe he's specifically addressing the issue of marriage. I do not believe he is addressing a more global acceptance of the sexual revolution, because I actually think that the influence of sexual revolutionaries is that they've overreached. And we're actually going to see culture respond to it in the same way that John Stone Street and I were just talking about culture having responded to abortion. At some point, the influence of grassroots Christians does have traction. And so this survey is interesting, particularly in light of the comments by Richard Land in relationship to the influence of conservative Christians in the Trump administration transition team and upon those who are being called to serve in senior level positions in the incoming administration. So just highlighting a few things from this Pew Research report. If you were to just look at the numbers, the group that everyone perceives to be gaining influence in the Trump era are wealthy people, white people, men, and conservative Christians. Everyone else is perceived as going to lose influence at some level. And so I just think that if you're going to talk about losers and winners and you're going to talk about how you're going to use your platform to elevate people who may be otherwise sidelined from the conversation, because if you've been sidelined from the conversation in the last 8 years, you know how it feels. And you know that that is not the righteous way to make anyone else feel. So how are we going to share our platform with folks who otherwise might have a very difficult time making themselves heard? So if you were to look further down the list, old people, young people, and children are perceived to be losers, as are women, which I actually find incredibly curious. I want to talk about this for just a minute. Kellyanne Conway is a woman of influence. I mean, you can love her or not, but she is a woman of influence, and she is going to be a power broker in this administration. I don't think she's a woman to be trifled with. She seems absolutely unflappable. She's totally on message. She is at Donald Trump's right hand. She is his senior advisor, and she appears to have great room to range in terms of her areas of influence. I also think that that Ivanka Trump should not be underestimated as an advisor to the president. And I think that if you're going to talk about folks who are close to him, who influence the president, if you say that women are going to lose their influence, it's only because you have defined women in some narrow category that needs to be obliterated. Okay? Because I don't think women lose their influence in this administration. I think different women are elevated in influence. And I think a different message about women is elevated in influence. You cannot look at Nikki Haley and you cannot look at Betsy DeVos and say to yourself, you know what, he doesn't have any women in his cabinet. And you can't look at Kellyanne Conway and Ivanka Trump and Marsha Blackburn and say he isn't elevating women around him to positions of significant leadership. So just because the women that the far left appreciates seeing elevated in leadership, just because those people are losing their influence, does not mean that women in general are losing their influence in this administration. Okay, so that sort of brings me to this ongoing drama. I'll call it a drama. I've been watching it like a drama of these Senate confirmation hearings. Okay, there's not enough time in any of our lives, even if we were just glued to the television 24/7, we couldn't watch all of these Senate confirmation hearings because some of them take place simultaneously. And so you have to pick and choose. And you're also saying, you know, I'm trying to live my life. I have a job to do. I got kids to raise. You know, I got people to see and places to go, and the sun rises and sets, and I got to see that too. So so we keep an eye and an ear on these things for you. And I just would like to say, from a Christian worldview perspective, there are a few things that I want to highlight as we think about these people sitting under scrutiny, some of them for days. And I just want to talk about what that is like and how prepared you think you would be to sit in that kind of pressure cooker. You can watch the highlights. There's actually a full schedule of all of this posted at upi.com. So that's a full schedule of the Senate confirmation hearings and who's being, I'll say, examined when and for how long and who's doing the examining, those kinds of things. You would have to add to the list Sonny Perdue, who has just been named Trump's nominee for Commissioner of Agriculture. Sonny Perdue, he's from Georgia, in case that name is not familiar to you, and he is a chicken guy. Okay, that's what I have for you on that. So it seems to me that at times the senators who are asking the questions are literally trying to see if they can put the candidate on the defensive. That sometimes seems to be the goal. Will this person crack under pressure? And I think that's a good question for each one of us to ask about ourselves. Like, if you were in that kind of hot seat, not that specific hot seat about these specific issues, but if for some reason you were just, you know, put in a hot seat in front of a panel of people, how ready are you for that kind of, you know, to be Christ in that environment? How ready are you to give what, you know, Scripture describes as a ready defense for the hope that's in you? Can you give a ready defense without becoming defensive? That's really the question. Can you give a ready defense for the hope that's within you? Can you give a ready defense for the truth that you advocate, for the truth that you want to honor, for the truth that you want to speak? Can you do so in a way that's not defensive? You'll notice that Jesus, in articulating the gospel, in articulating what the kingdom of God is like, in articulating who God is and what he wants, was never on the defensive. He was put on the defense a lot. There were a lot of people who came up and asked him questions seeking to trick him, right? But never does he become defensive. And so this is not just about having the mind of Christ in the matters of the day. This is also about having the spirit of Christ in how we answer those who are seeking to trick us or seeking to make us defensive or seeking to have us crack under pressure. By the way, if you crack under pressure, be sure that what comes out is the spirit of the living God. Right? So if we are actually pressed to the point of cracking under pressure, we don't want for it to then be shown forth that our life is full of something other than the Spirit of God. You're full of something. Everybody's full of something. You've probably been told before you're full of something. I certainly have. What are you full of? Don't be full of the things of the world. Be full of the Spirit. John, who is my producer, is pointing at his coffee cup. He is full of caffeine. So probably is my line producer, Bobby. Okay, so it's time for me to go below the fold. This is the point in the show where we like to lift up stories and talk about stuff that's designed to help you start and engage in the kinds of conversations that are easy to start and engage in, because they're not about stuff that's explicitly like, you know, Jesus-y. But they provide for you opportunities to introduce spiritual principles into a conversation, eternal principles, and help people genuinely reconnect the eternal with the everyday. So, this story is pulled off from The Hill, and the title is 4-year-old who has read 1,000 books named Librarian for the Day at the Library of Congress. Now, I would like to juxtapose this story against one that I read at Smithsonian.org, which says that 25% of American adults didn't read a single book in all of last year. So let's just talk about that for a minute. Okay, no, that's not the subject. The subject is the good news story about this 4-year-old who has already read 1,000 books. I didn't even know that there is a program called 1,000 Books Before Kindergarten, but there is. We apparently have programs for everything now. So this particular kindergartner, she's from Georgia. She's described here, her name is Dahlia. She's described here as a 4-year-old bibliophile, which she probably knows the meaning of because she's read 1,000 books. So she got to shadow the Librarian of Congress, whose name is Carla Hayden, on Thursday. And so, Dahlia appears from all the pictures to be living the dream, man. She is living the dream. She is, the word they use is shadowing. She is shadowing the Librarian of Congress. And they are walking around the halls of the Library of Congress. And by the way, Dahlia, the 4-year-old who's read 1,000 books, was invited to sit in with their staff and give them some feedback and make suggestions. So here's her one big suggestion. She says the Library of Congress should have whiteboards in the hallways so kids can practice writing, which is much better than writing on the walls. So there you go. There you have it. And then, see, you're immediately leaping in your mind to whether or not we can read the writing on the walls, right? I'm just saying, there is a way into a biblical conversation. I don't care what the article is about. So obviously there's a conversation here to be had with your neighbors about what they're reading, whether or not they're reading. If 25% of Americans didn't read a book at all last year, then there's a starting point. Because what is one book that we're certainly hoping every American at some point during the year takes a look at? We hope it's the Bible. If 25% of Americans didn't read a book last year, then at those 25% of Americans certainly didn't read the Bible last year. All right? So so that's a starting point of conversation. Are you reading the Bible? This is not a question from me to you. This is a question from you to your neighbor. Right? Here's a kid who read 1,000 books. Have you read one? Have you read the good one? Have you read the best one? There's a really good book. How about we read it together? It's an invitation for you over coffee. All right, so the other thing that I want to lift up from this story is the beauty, the absolute beauty of the language that's used. This article is so brief. It's like 5 paragraphs. But the beauty of the language of shadowing. More than once, that word is used to describe Dahlia's experience with the Librarian of Congress, Miss Hayden. She's shadowing her. And there's one picture that's described this way. They're walking together, both with their hands rested behind their backs, the four-year-old looking up at Hayden in awe. When's the last time you walked with a four-year-old in a place that they dream about, in a job that they dream about having? And you are such a pattern that they want to follow that they're actually physically mimicking you and looking up at you in awe. Friends, as Christians, this is what discipleship is really all about. It is about walking with other people in their dreams, right? It's about walking with them in the places where they feel called to go. And they want to grow up to be like you in those places and in those roles. And so you have the opportunity to be the curriculum. You have the opportunity to be the discipleship curriculum in the life of another person. The question is, do we live like that? Do we invite people to shadow us? And if they were to shadow us, would they become more like Jesus? Would there be any reason for them to even physically pattern the way they walk in our steps, because we are so faithfully walking in the way of Christ? That's the question that this article provokes. The other thing that this article that I learned today is that when I lifted this up as what I thought we would talk about today in the Below the Fold, Amanda, who is my communications director, lit up like a light bulb. I had no idea that she wasn't in her dream job. Imagine that. That being the Librarian of Congress is her dream job. Like getting to do this is her dream job. Who knew that? So maybe part of the conversation that you could start with other people is, you know, Dahlia at four already, man, she's already got a dream in her heart, doesn't she? She has already got a dream in her heart, and she's moving. She's doing what she needs to do to move toward her dream. I feel like if you've read 1,000 books by the time you're four, and your goal is to read another 500 before you get into kindergarten, first of all, you're not only goal oriented, you are a good person at actually checking things off the list, which I think for the Librarian of Congress would be kind of important. She has a vision set before her, and she has a person who is in a role who she respects, who she wants to be like. And so this is a conversation that each one of us should be having with other people in our lives. What do you know, you may not be in your dream job now, but what is your dream? How big do you dream? You know, I'm thinking back to Monday of this week. Martin Luther King Jr. had a dream. It was big. It was God-sized. And there's no way that all by himself he could have ever advanced that dream toward reality. And I recognize that in some ways we have not attained yet that dream. But one of the things you ought to know about Dahlia, and frankly one of the things that you ought to know about Miss Hayden, who is the librarian of the Library of Congress, are that they're both obviously female. And they're both people of color. And so, in some ways, they personify the reality of the dream that Martin Luther King Jr. dreamed. The outgoing president of the United States is an African American. The Supreme Court justice who will be swearing in the new president and vice president of the United States is an African American. The Librarian of Congress is a person of color, and she is the person that Dahlia Arana, a four-year-old from Georgia, wants to be. What's your dream for our culture? What's your dream for your family? What's your dream? How big is it? Is it God-sized? Is it something culture transforming like the dream of Martin Luther King Jr.? If not, then let me invite you to dream bigger. Dream bigger. All right, so my shout out today is to Dahlia. If we knew how to send her a book, we would. Maybe that's what we should all do. Well, what we should all do is we should figure out how to all send Dahlia another book. She may actually be beyond the reading level of some of us, but let's go ahead. Let's load her up with books. Let's make sure that this little girl in Georgia never lacks for another book to read. And let's ask our friends, you know, what are they reading? Are they reading the good book? And if not, let's be sure that they have one. Let's be sure they have a Bible, and let's read it with them. All right, friends, we've got a survey posted at the website, reconnectwithcarmen.com. I would love to get your feedback there. It is fun for me to know what you're thinking about. It's fun for me to know what's helping you in what we're doing, and the things that we could do to help you more. I love to be with you every day. I'd love it if you'd share today's show with someone else. You could sign up for the podcast and the email that we send out so you don't miss anything. This is The Reconnect. Have a great day, and God bless.
The Reconnect is brought to you by the Presbyterian Lay Committee. To continue the conversation and become part of the Reconnect community, visit reconnectwithcarmen.com.